Friday on Flashpoints, we'll spend most of the hour talking about the state of Georgia's lynching of Troy Anthony Davis in the context of living in the most violent country in the history of the world. Also, we'll be joined by Barbara Lubin for an update on the Oakland Children's Museum's decision to censor the art of Palestinian children after it was scheduled, announced, and ready to go. And Nora Barris-Friedman will give us an update on the trial in Los Angeles where a local prosecutor is trying to send Muslim students to jail for committing civil disobedience. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. In one moment, we're going to be joined by Kevin Gray, author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, the Fundamentals of Black Politics. Well, he's joining us from South Carolina, knows a lot about the violent South and the violent United States and what the violent United States has been doing, not just here at home, killing innocents, but killing them abroad. But first, we want to just remember that the state of Georgia lynched an innocent black man. Lynched an innocent black man. We want to hear from the attorney from the NAACP last night after the announcement was made that the state of Georgia murdered another innocent black man with a history of doing the same. Lynchings continue in Georgia. Listen to this.
I'm one of Troy Davis's lawyers, Mr. Jason Ewart of Arnold and Porter, and I, as two of Mr. Davis's witnesses, witnessed what I regard as a legalized lynching. Mr. Ewart also is one of Troy's lawyers. What I basically say is that this is a circumstance where, first of all, Troy, Mr. Davis, very bravely, in the morally upright fashion that he's always conducted himself around me, in very clear terms, spoke to three classes of people. First of all, he spoke to the McPhail family. And he said to them, without equivocation, that he didn't kill Mark McPhail, that he didn't even have a gun on the night of August 18, 1989, and that he had nothing to do with the violence that resulted in Officer McPhail's death. Then he said something to the McPhail family, to his own family, and to his supporters. And that was that he would certainly hope that the McPhail family, and certainly he urged his own family and his supporters to go deeper into this case and bring the McPhail family, that is for his lawyers, most definitely his family, including, I would say, our leader in this, Martina Correa, and his sister Kim Davis, for them to lead the McPhail family into a deeper scrutiny into this case so that they can see two things, that Troy Davis did not kill Officer McPhail, but rather that someone else did. And then, in his final words, he more or less called upon everybody who would want what's right, want what's morally right, and whatever this thing called justice is, if it means anything good, who want that, to bring an end to this madness called capital punishment as it's applied in the United States. And out of all of that, I basically say that Troy Davis, whose case was one that was, you say, riddled with doubt, it was riddled with sworn recantations from the witnesses who put him in the place where he was convicted by a predominantly white jury and a white judge and then sentenced to death. Seven of those nine witnesses recanted, and then additional witnesses under oath came forward and identified the actual perpetrator of the crime. And if in that situation, Georgia and the United States can kill somebody who's actually innocent, that's not just a legalized lynching. That's a threat to all innocent life in this society.
And that was Thomas Ruffin, an attorney for Troy Anthony Davis, bringing the news that the state of Georgia lynched one more black man with a history of lynching. You're listening to Flashpoints. Now we're going to listen to Martina Correa, Troy Davis's sister, struggling with cancer, spoke before the murder, stood up from her wheelchair, and made the following statement.
My name is Martina Davis Correa. I'm the eldest sister of five brothers and sisters, including Troy Anthony Davis, who is scheduled to be executed in Georgia tonight. I would like to say that we are very disappointed by what is taking place in Georgia, and it's like this state wants to remain defiant. The parole board said to us in 2007 that they would not execute when there is doubt. And every year we come upon this case, there's more and more doubt. Yet the case, the state pushes for an execution. We are saddened by this. We are very upset by this. And I want people to understand that our family is hurting too, but we will not give up this fight. So I said that this fight did not begin with him, and this movement should not end with him. Because if we can amass millions of people to stand up and say we will not stand for this, then we can end the death penalty.
Yes.
And that's what we need to do. Because we should not live in a state when people are being executed when there's doubt. A lot of people want to know, what did you say to your brother? How does he feel? What did he say to you? Well, I try to tell people that that's something that's very personal to our family. And I don't feel like dissecting every comment he makes is for the media, because of the fact that his life hangs in the balance and he knows that he's an innocent man. I really appreciate all the organizations and the legal people from all over the world, ambassadors. We have so many people, scholars, even police officers and agencies and organizations that you would never normally see working together, because everyone is saying, we have the facts now. It's in black and white. When I started this working against the death penalty and trying to save my brother's life, everyone said, because she's a sister, she had to be lying. So what we had to do is show it to them in black and white. And once people saw it in black and white, they became engaged in this case. And it grew worldwide. But sometimes, just because a movement grows and the truth comes out, we still have people that are not willing to change their old ways. And I'm here to tell you today that no matter what happens this evening, the old South will fall.
And, well, I don't know if the old South has fallen. I was just looking at a major advertisement for the Redneck Shop in South Carolina. I remember when I was investigating over 100 church burnings throughout the South in 1996, only a year after Mississippi State ratified the anti-slavery amendment to the Constitution, the Klan Shop, and it's still doing well, selling racism. I guess the flag, the Confederate flag, only came down in South Carolina in 1990. And we're going to take a look at the violence in this country. We're going to take a look at what happened last night. But more to the point, we're going to take a look at what has happened in this country. We're going to talk about the violence that is pervasive in the U.S. way of life, the U.S. government policy, which now dominates the world. It's not a new story. For many decades, the United States has demonstrated a pattern of extreme violence against any so-called opponent of the state that gets in the way. 1 million children murdered by a U.S. embargo in Iraq. The slaughter of the innocents by drones in Afghanistan, Pakistan. The unchecked and expanding nuclear arsenal that now includes dominance of the world from space demonstrates that this pattern is continuing. From the death penalty to global dominance, violence to control. We're going to talk about this pervasive violence and its implications. Delighted to be joined by Kevin Gray. Gray is the author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. He said today, Troy's death is tragic, but this country, not just its individual states, kills everywhere in Iraq, Afghanistan, and many other places around the world. We grieve for Troy as we grieve for the anonymous souls killed by drones or U.S. and NATO bombs, assassination teams. We have to find a way to stop all of this killing. Gray joins us from that great state of South Carolina. Kevin Gray, welcome to Flashpoints. Have you been to the Klan shop lately?
Not lately, you know. Now, and I have a friend who tried to close the Klan shop down while I was president of the ACLU here in the state. I think I was president of the ACLU here for about close to 20 years. And, of course, back during the flag debate here, we had tried to sue to have the flag removed from the state house as a First Amendment case, claiming that it would represent a compelled speech, that we were being forced to submit to a flag that represented the ideology of white supremacy and slavery. So when the NAACP launched a boycott, of course, I, with a group of people in my organization, the Harriet Tubman Freedom House Project, sewed a Confederate Nazi flag together and went to the base of the Confederate Soldiers Memorial on Confederate Memorial Day and set fire to that flag. So I have an intimate knowledge of the flag debate, and I'm a native South Carolinian. Now, well, I was born in Boston, but my father's from here, and I've been here all my life. And, you know, South Carolina is, we believe it to be the heart of white supremacy in this country. When you talk about Rick Perry and the Tea Party and this whole idea of neoconservatism, it starts here. It starts with what happened at Fort Sumter and all this idea about states' rights. And so, you know, a lot of what's going on here in South Carolina, you know, in Georgia and South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, it's red state South. It's still about race. Well, still about race around the world, but, you know, they're very clear about it. And they don't, you know, that's, I tell folk now, that's one of the things that you can like about the South. At least you know who your enemy is. They do not make any pretense about it.
Well, sometimes, you know, when I got to Mississippi in 1996 on the church burning investigation, I interviewed the head of public safety for the state of Mississippi. His name was James Ingram. When I went into his office, there was a Confederate flag on the wall, and there was a picture of him shaking hands with J. Edgar Hoover. It turns out the man in charge of investigating the church burnings in Mississippi in 1996 was actually number three man in the COINTELPRO program. He's the guy. Ingram went to down south to Meridian, Mississippi, and made the statement that those folks who disappeared there, it was just a ploy by the NAACP to get sympathy. So that was 1996.
Well, it's surprising that we didn't meet during the church fire issue down here, because I think I did some hearings and some organizing around, because I was editing a black newspaper then, and when the fires first started, of course they all just start one here, one there, and people weren't picking up on the trend. But, you know, and those kinds of things, those kinds of outward expressions by generally low-income whites in regards to race, it happens not as much as it used to, but it happens in cycles. Things are much more sophisticated now because, as I said, you've got the hard right that's taking over government. So you don't really have to terrorize anybody if you're legislating terror. And so that's where we're at.
Right. We've got the White Citizens Council in the U.S. Congress holding sway.
Basically, you're right. I mean, when you think about it, what was it last year that Jeff Sessions was and Lindsey Graham and a lot of Southern legislators were talking about amending the 14th Amendment? and anchor babies, and then some of us said, well, look, the 14th Amendment, that's about citizenship for not just undocumented Latinos, that's about citizenship for ex-enslaved Africans. And Sessions says, well, I don't know why you would think that. Now, his name is Jefferson Beauregard Sessions.
I know.
He knows. He knows. So you know.
And he's the guy, as a U.S. attorney in the 60s, tortured black people, indicted them. You know, they'd have their churches burned, and he'd indict them for burning their own churches and voter fraud. This is the same guy who's now in the Senate.
And this is the and this is the core of the Tea Party and neoconservative movement in America and the Southernization of politics in America. But now that's, you know, and it is all about conquest. It's all about being mean. It's all about white supremacy. And when you talk about white supremacy, then you get into the criminal justice system. Then you get into war and who dies and who lives.
That's right. Well, that's what we're going to talk more about now. It is really good to have you with us, Kevin Gray. I know that you've thought a lot about what happened in terms of, in context of Troy Davis. Let me just give you a minute or two to respond to that directly, and then I want to expand this discussion out and talk about the sort of the extraordinary violence that dominates U.S. policy, from the State House, from these executions, to the global control, from with every kind of military operation from every angle, including space. But first, a response to the lynching. Is it a lynching? Do you consider it a state-sponsored lynching there in Georgia?
Well, you know, it was murder. And if you shoot them in the head, you lynch them, you stick a needle in their vein, he was murdered, and I'm good with that. Of course, I've done death penalty work for a long time, and as tragic as this is, the ultimate victory for Troy and for people who want to see a more peaceful society, a less violent society, then Troy's life was not in vain. He didn't willingly give up his life, but he didn't lose his life in vain. I think that that's obvious. And if sometimes it takes a single incident to shake people up. You know, Troy, you know, folks had to reconcile being against the death penalty for Troy Davis and being for the death penalty for the what's the brother named Brewer, who killed Jesse Byrd,
right,
and Jasper. So it made people think, and it made people think in the context of where America ranks with other nations, and then you watch the Republican debate, and there are people cheering Rick Perry talk about executing people, and that embarrassed the country. And then, of course, people are so depressed and so anxious about government, they're getting involved. The millions of people that got involved in the Troy Davis case, it was a way that they could get involved, even if they could only get involved online, even if they could only be aware of it and say to people they ought not kill that man. And so, you know, people looking for little ways to get involved because things are wrong, and they're looking for the place to start changing it. The kids out from Howard getting arrested at the White House. I mean, you've got kids being arrested in New York right now in Wall Street, and you had people getting arrested on the tar sand issue at the White House last week. But when's the last time you saw black kids out there, college kids out there, actively putting their bodies on the line for something, which I think is significant.
Yes.
And so when you talk about mobilizing the people that you need to push back on all this violence and killing that goes on in our country and outside our country, Troy was a good example of millions of people. They could not save what they thought was one innocent man, but it might spur them to try to force this government inside and out this country to stop killing so many innocent people.
All right. Let's talk about killing innocent people as a way of life, as a policy of the United States government. You know, I interviewed Ben Jealous a couple of days before the killing.
He did a wonderful job last night. That was the most I've ever listened to Ben Jealous since his tenure at the NAACP. A lot of that was due to Amy Goodwin's personal coverage of that tragedy.
Now, the thing is, when I interviewed him, and I didn't put this, I published the interview, but I left most of the exchange out. But when I talked to him on the air, I asked him about the responsibility of the president. We're asking every citizen, that word citizen kept coming up, every citizen, including actors and judges and federal agents and attorney and assistant attorney generals and stars and the Pope and the former leaders of the we got into it a little bit. Doesn't the president have a responsibility to speak out? Or maybe he doesn't have the authority anymore because he's the head and very actively and aggressively conducting a killing machine abroad. What? How do you respond to that?
Well, I did a show earlier today, and they played a clip of Obama joking with some little musical act that was at the White House that was his kid's age, I think Malia's age, and he says, now don't get any ideas. If you do, I got two words: predator drones. Now, he joked about that. Now these folks are killing kids and families in the mountains of Afghanistan. They don't even know who they're killing, but it's a punchline on the joke for him. Now, he could say something if he wanted to. Obviously, he has no constitutional power to stop anything, but he could say something if he wanted to. He said something about Skip Gates's case, even when his friend ended up going to jail on the porch of his house when Officer Crowley truly profiled him. And so you would think if he can invite what I consider a racist cop to the White House so that he can keep his credibility with the police organizations, then if he wanted to, he could say whatever he wants to say. You know, but in that, when I go back and look at presidents, modern contemporary presidents, I was working on this project on our Sirius radio show on 9/11. We talked about 9/11, but then we talked about the number of wars and police actions and U.S. Interest involved kind of coups and that kind of thing. We talked about that also, the number of tragedies that nations have been befallen on at the hands of the United States government. And millions and millions of people. And when you go back and look at the various presidents and the various administrations, there is a continuity. And when you sign up for that job, it's almost like you've got to agree to commit mass murder at the interest request. And so Obama is no different. Look at Libya. And now, I'm not a fan of Gaddafi, but this idea that the multinationals in France and Britain and the oil companies are going to basically seize those people's resources, which is the fight that's been going on since the end of World War II when they carved up the Middle East for the oil companies. I mean, everybody forgets that the only reason that we hate Iran is because Mossadegh nationalized the oil companies, Anglo-Iranian oil company, which was the founding organization. It's where BP comes from. And we're still fighting that war for BP. The only reason that we had any relationships with Saddam Hussein and Donald Rumsfeld would go meet with Saddam Hussein to provide them with weapons to kill Iranians was because of that oil. So, you know, the folk got to get a grip on this country has killed millions of people, even since World War II, millions. If you're talking about, 1 to 3 million in Vietnam, how many did we kill during the Korean War? How many, 200,000, 300,000 in East Timor? There are figures, depending upon who you want to believe, on Iraq, that we've killed somewhere between 1 and 2 million people in Iraq from the first George Bush to now. So people need to wise up. You know, on 9/11, everybody, well, the day America lost its innocence. America had never been innocent. And it certainly hasn't been innocent in my lifetime. And so this idea that our lives or the lives of a certain group of people are more valuable than everybody else's, then that's what we got to come to grips with, that the lives of people of color, be it in America or outside America, seem to have no value to this country. And they kill them, and they steal their resources at the drop of a dime, at the drop of a bomb, at the push of a needle.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Kevin Gray. He's an author. He's been many things in this world, done great work for the people. He's the author of Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. And we're sort of expanding the discussion of violence and state-sponsored violence from the death penalty against one person. I mean, I was thinking, Kevin Gray, I was thinking, well, God, we're not quite as bad as Iran. They're doing 20 executions at a time. And then I'm thinking, but now we're running the drone war from the CIA, and we're creating the intelligence that justifies the buttons that are being pushed from the same room.
Listen, if America stopped killing people right now, other nations that would be hard-pressed to try to catch up. Now, as I said, even let's look at the first Iraq war, and I was talking to somebody, how I'm doing this research on this list when we did this show, and I'm like, I didn't really mean to get into it so deeply when I was pulling together the list. I just wanted to talk about this idea of America believing that their lives and their experiences have more value and more tragedy than anybody else's. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, obviously, 9/11 was horrible, and anybody dying, I'm against people dying, and I'm against and being murdered needlessly over ideology and over someone believing that they can tell them how they should live their lives or what God they should praise. So I wasn't with Osama bin Laden, although I was opposed to his execution and assassination without due process. That was capital punishment. And that was a dangerous thing when any nation, when the president of the United States could just send somebody in to kill somebody, and that's all it said. Nothing else is said. That's dangerous. But this idea of, you know, I was looking at Iraq and the highway of death, and I was an army officer. And I got out the army during the first Gulf War because I didn't want to go. And when you think about all those Iraqis that were leaving Kuwait on the so-called highway of death, and the numbers range between 100 and 200,000 people that they killed retreating.
They mowed them down.
So when you talk about even comparing the United States to another nation in terms of its use of the death penalty, well, our ultimate death penalty is war, where we just take them out in large numbers. It's awful. When people look at the numbers and really think about it, I mean, how many people did this country kill going to put to capture Noriega? People don't think about that.
2,000.
Yeah, 2,000 or 3,000 people that died. People don't think about
for that. For an arrest of a drug dealer that they supported.
And who, when you mention East Timor to anybody and why Henry Kissinger can't go to certain places around the world, who remembers East Timor? Who knows on a map where East Timor was? Where it's at? Who knows that 95% of those weapons that Suharto used to kill the East Timorians or Timorese were from the United States? Who, you know, at some point, this idea of the day we lost our innocence, we lost 3,000 people. Then that's a tragedy. But we have inflicted far more damage on people. We have killed far more people than any other nation. We're trying to hold nations to a standard that we don't seem to be able to hold ourselves to. We think we're a peaceful nation. We're the most warlike nation, as Dr. King said. We're the largest purveyor of violence on the globe today.
You know, I'm remembering Kevin Gray, the statistician in the Pentagon, I believe it was, who released that number, that it was somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000. I was on my way to talk to her via telephone. I had made an appointment in the morning. The way it was conveyed to me, somebody who worked closely in the office said that the coffee was still steaming on the table, and she was fired. You know, it was actually a couple of people in the office that released the information. But we do the killing, and then anybody who tries to speak up about it, you know, understands how important it is to be silent or to be ready to suffer for the rest of their lives. It is difficult to tell the truth when you're on the front line, wherever you are, watching the killing machine in action. But I think we are getting more and more outraged people who just happen to be there in the crossroads, on the crowd, in the crowd scenes of the violence, and can't keep their mouths shut. This discussion that we're having, Kevin Gray, we don't have a lot more time, but I really want to welcome you back. And the next time we talk, I have a few more minutes left with you, but I just want to let people know that I'm going to invite you back, and I want to open up the phones, and I want to have an open dialogue about this extraordinary violence, this government, this violent government that represents us, you know, the people all over the world, with, you know, diplomacy from 10,000 feet. You know, the smart bombs go to schools and all the kids that are playing in the playground end up playing freeze tag in the morgue.
Can you imagine our government and our military recruiting kids to kill people via computer? And what that does to their psychology. And everybody's wondering why you have all these soldiers coming back committing suicide or killing their families. You know, we all knew that this, anybody that had any sense about war and the psychology of war, that these are the byproducts of a violent society. And at some point it said we a sustainable society is not a violent society. We cannot. People, at some point in time, the world is going to stop being afraid, because that's what they are.
How do we, where does this dialogue, this transformation begin? You've thought deeply about these issues. You've been on every, at every angle. You've looked from up, down, inside, outside. Where does, in your mind, where does the struggle begin again, if you will?
Well, I mean, obviously the struggle has to begin from the top, from the bottom up instead of the top down, and which means that you have to pull together grassroots structures that really do political education and consciousness raising, because you can't just put people out in the streets or ask them to challenge government and they don't really know what direction that they want government to go in. So a lot of it is, and it's hard, heavy lifting, is the ideological part of it. What is a peaceful, sustainable society? What is a peaceful, sustainable economy? If we can start from there and build from that, you know, how can we get along better? What's best for our children's future and the nation's future? And even in this discussion, you know, we've got the president talking about the budget and deficits and tax cuts for rich and wealth inequity. And it's all about these wars and all this crony capitalism and defending these multinational corporations' right to exploit people and take people's lives for temporary material comfort here in this country. So, you know, it obviously we're going to have to live differently. It doesn't mean that the government ought to force austerity on poor people or reduce services that are needed, like roads and bridges and schools, but it means that the government can't spend 60% of that money killing people and waging war and buying weapons. can't do that anymore. You got to do something different. And so if you can, if, even if we start there, because as I said, the country looks like it's in economic crises. Well, let's look at where the money, the country's spending this money and doing what. And what they're doing it, using it for is killing. Killing, killing, and more killing. I said, when you start reading the data, and I suggest that people read or check out William Bloom's book, Killing Hope, where he chronicles all the wars that we've been in for the last 75 years and police actions. You know, it's awful. I didn't even mention El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras, or Chile. It's awful. And folk need to come to grips with that history. And that's where the change starts. It starts, you come to grips with the history, and then you incorporate what you've learned into your psychology. You don't just read it and walk past it like it was just a piece of paper with some scribble on it. You integrate that into your actions and how you view things and how you vote and what you vote for. And then there are some things you can do. I mean, there's still short of revolution. I mean, working to have multi-party politics, and changing the electoral system there. It's doing education door to door and moving outside your comfort zone and going out and meet people in other neighborhoods. It's understanding the basics of our society. What is good about our society? Because one of the things about the Troy Davis case that I've been saying to people is, you know, first of all, you know, and Troy, for people that do death penalty cases, because you don't always get the case like Troy Davis. I had a case, Richard Johnson, that I worked back in maybe 10, 15 years ago, and we thought he was innocent. Most cases, you'll get, the person will be guilty. Now, someone who kills someone at 17, 18, 19, 20, and you go through that 20-year process of adjudication, by the time they get to be where they're going about to be murdered by the state, they're not the same person. You're not even, the state isn't even murdering the same person that murdered the original person. So, you know, but Troy was a, you know, he wasn't Brewer. So people could be with Troy. But, you know, you use that case and you use that energy to learn more about what our country's about. You do the local organizing and you talk about the death penalty. That means you have to get involved with the families on both sides. That means you have to figure out how to organize to go to court. In some cases, you know, just like Troy had to do, because you don't start out challenging the system with everybody with you. Usually when you start out, nobody believes you. And so, you know, there are all kinds of things that people can do, but the first thing they need to do is get a consciousness of what it is that we're dealing with. And that's where I think we start. And I think that's what Troy's case has been good for.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Kevin Gray. He's an author. He's been many things. He's been on the front line of civil rights, but really he's a historian of, I guess you have to say, you become, to study the United States history and to study U.S. policy, you have to be an expert in state-sponsored violence. We have as our forward fighting tool, a key aspect of U.S. forward fighting tool, is a massive kidnapping and torture program.
Well, you ask a Native American how peaceful the United States has been. You know, every time I listen to these Republicans talk about, well, it used to be great back in 1965. Oh, really? And so, you know, and then we think about the Civil War. I mean, as I said, this country has been at war every 20 years since its formation. That's where we're at. And with more powerful weapons, we've killed more people. I mean, it's a World War II. They call that the Good War. But look how it ended. We dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And people are still talking about whether or not that was the right thing to do. And now this idea of collateral damage, shock and awe. Let's bomb the people. Let's destroy the infrastructure. We look at Libya and the U.S. supporting the NATO bombing of Libya and the purging of black Africans from Libya. You know, it's today, if you go online, they'll list the casualties in Afghanistan. The headline in AP is this month, America's deadliest and long Afghan war. Now, if you go back and ask somebody, well, how many Afghans have died since 2007? We're about 9,000 to 10,000. And so, you know, we get the constant numbers of how many Americans are killed, but no one seems to want to talk about how many people we are killing. And so I said, so you can't really disconnect just this vengeful, mean killing machine that this country is. Now, folk might not like to hear it be it said, but just look at the history. And that's not even making a so-called moral, taking a position whether or not a war is moral or immoral, right or wrong. That's just saying, look, this is the tally.
All right. Kevin Gray, it's been very good to have you with us and to be able to expand this discussion out. And I would love you to come back in the near future, and we're going to open up a dialogue with the audience, and we're going to continue to talk about, because this is what it's about. It's about dealing with this unchecked, out-of-control, corporate, military, corporate-driven violence that demands global control and more resources. We didn't even talk about the expansion and the militarization and the setting up of the U.S. military structure in Africa to seize and control every aspect of the resources, the rich resources in that part of the world. There's so much to talk about, but let me thank you for at least opening the door for us, and hopefully you will come back. If people want to follow your work on a regular basis, what do you suggest? What's the best way to do it?
Well, I just tell them to just Google my name. But I've got a lot of stuff on Counterpunch, a lot of stuff with the Progressive. I have a blog. It's, you know, I don't work that blog every day. It's just when I get a notion to post stuff, which I do pretty regularly, but I'm not a daily blogger. It's the New Liberator at WordPress. But that's where most of my I just kind of park my stuff. But, you know, my stuff is related to the work. So usually, if I'm working, I'm not writing. And if I'm writing, I'm not working.
All right. Yeah. Well, you definitely got the writing or working. You've got the right idea about work. We want to continue to explore these crucial issues with you. Thanks for being with us on Flashpoint.
Thank you, brother.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short musical break. I'm going to inhale, and then hopefully I'll be able to exhale. And then we're going to be joined by Nora Barris Friedman and Barbara Lubin. We got a lot to talk about. Stay with us.
This is Troy Anthony Davis. I've been sitting on charge of death row for a crime I did not commit. I will never take another human being's life. And this killer's still out there. My family's in mourning. The biggest family's in mourning. And the truth is still locked in because I didn't get justice.
Does the court system employ racists? Then why are so many black boys in cages? Why shouldn't I be paranoid of hatred? Just look at the curious case of Troy Davis. Let's travel on down to Savannah, in the state of Georgia, just south of Atlanta, where they wave a rebel flag like a bandana. Hunger ancestors in pose for the cameras. A white police officer was shot and killed over an argument. He tried to stop and heal, but here's where the plot gets real. The main suspect blamed Troy, went to the cops and squealed. And with no physical evidence of weapon, Troy was arrested for a 187. He said he was an innocent man when he was questioned, but they said he did it. Who needs a damn confession? They just need a witness they can press to cry. Tell them what to say or they'll arrest the guy. Then put them on a stand and make them testify. Swear to God, tell the truth and do their best to lie. And they did, so Troy was found guilty.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to turn our attention to two aspects of, I guess, similar stories. But let's go to Los Angeles, where we're joined by Nora Barris Friedman, who is waiting at the edge of her chair in the Garden Spot of the West. Nora, where are you now?
I am still in Orange County, just south of Los Angeles, and I spent a few hours today outside the courtroom where the Irvine 11 trial verdict is supposed to come through. It didn't come through yesterday. The jury was still deliberating today. So everybody is hoping that tomorrow will be the day when we get a verdict, and of course, you know, people are hoping that the verdict is a just one, that exonerates and acquits these students who decided to speak up and speak their mind and exercise their right to free speech.
And every day that they don't reach a verdict is more money, more expense for what? What did they do?
Yeah, they protested an Israeli official's speech nonviolently using the time-honored tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience. You know, as I've been reporting on Flashpoints and on the Electronic Intifada, you know, those tenets of the First Amendment are now under threat, as the district attorney's office here in Orange County has taken it upon themselves to try and prosecute these students and turn them into criminals.
All right, stand by there. Joining us in Berkeley is Barbara Lubin, one of the founders of the Middle East Children's Alliance. Barbara, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks, Dennis. Hi, Nora.
Hi, Barb.
How you doing?
All right. Barbara,
yes.
We've been talking about what I consider an extreme censorship action. The Oakland's the Children's Museum of Oakland, after advertising, preparing, announcing that there would be a show of art by Palestinian children, after the invitations went out, after the workshops were set up, the Children's Museum shut them down, cut out the children, I guess didn't care much about the high hopes that these kids would have had to be able to share their work and their feelings, the Children's Museum, and, of course, those very influential Jewish groups who, I guess, put on the pressure to put on the screws that said maybe they'd never raise another red cent, had their way, and the kids were left out. Where does that situation lie now? Has the Children's Museum relented on their censorship and their sort of what I would consider racist brutality against these Palestinian kids?
No, Dennis. If you remember last time I was on, I told you that we had sent a letter to MoCut, the Children's Museum, telling them that we expected to hear from them by last Thursday, I believe it was, at 12 o'clock. And the head of the board, in fact, left a message on Mecca's machine saying that that the board, in fact, decided not to change its mind and that we were not going to be allowed to hang the exhibit. So as it stands now, we promised the children and we promised everyone that on the date that we were to hang the exhibit in the museum, we would be outside the museum in the courtyard, standing there, holding each of the paintings of the children, and that their voices will still be heard, if not being hung on the wall inside, they'll be outside being held by many loving community people.
You think there'll be any of the museum workers outside holding the paintings?
I don't know. I know that so many of the women that I've spoken to who do work in the museum are heartbroken, and I think they would really like to be with us, but are conflicted because, you know, it's hard to find a new job these days, Dennis.
It is hard to find a new job. It's also hard to have a conscience.
Yeah, well.
Because, again, and I just feel so strongly about this. This is the Children's Museum. Now, I know they're influenced by some vicious actions, by very aggressive, threatening major Jewish organizations, but this is the Children's Museum. They made a problem to these kids. They sent them the invitation so the kids know that it was advertised.
The kids now know that it's not happening. Our project
their reactions?
Director, Dr. Mona has met with all the children, pulled them together, and has talked with them and told them that that there are people here in the United States, the museum in particular, who do not want to hear their voices or see the pictures that they have drawn. And the kids are extremely upset and, in fact, are now drawing more pictures to try and deal with the feelings they have about being told that their voices are not important. And, you know, when this program was set up, it's called Let the Children Play and Heal. A Gaza psychiatrist had written this, and I think it's important to remember what happened to these kids 2.5 years ago. You know, the constant bombardment and killing and maiming of over 2,000 people were murdered, and about 400 of them were little children. And the psychiatrist wrote at the end of that war that the majority of children suffer many psychological and social consequences. Insecurity and feelings of helplessness and powerlessness are overwhelming. We observe children becoming more anxious, sleep disturbances, nightmares, night terror, regressive behavior such as clinging to parents, bedwetting, becoming more restless and hyperactive, refusal to sleep alone, all the time wanting to be with their parents, overwhelmed by fears and worries. And that's why we set up this project, to help kids deal with what they had witnessed. And it's pretty disgusting to tell the children that that's not important, that people here are not going to see it. And it's an incredible situation.
Well, we're going to try and put some of those kids on the air, but Barbara, we're running out of time. So the exhibition will take place outside the museum. Where exactly, for people who are in the Bay Area, in Oakland, where exactly,
yes,
if they want to go and maybe hold one of the paintings?
Yes, we need people to come and hold the paintings. This is going to happen this Saturday, September 24th, and it's going to be at the Children's Museum, which is where? At 538 9th Street. That's right. It's between Washington and I don't know what.
Okay.
In
538
Oakland.
9th Street in Oakland. 538
yes.
9th Street.
And I also just want to remind people that there are other things that are also going on. And one is a very important evening with Ali Abunima and Alice Walker on Wednesday, October 5th at the First Presbyterian Church in Oakland. And anybody that wants to call me about these two events is welcome to call 510-548-0542. Please come to both of
and
these.
And let me let people know that we are going to have Alice on for a little bit on the 27th. I think that's Tuesday to talk about this event. And also, she wrote a very powerful
piece
about, you know, what art and self-expression meant to her as a wounded child. Very moving. Again, the information, if people want to protest this extraordinary censorship, this cave-in to pressure, they can go where? How can they, Junior? What's the timing, all that?
At 1 o'clock on Saturday at MoCA, that's the Museum of Children's Art in Oakland, and that is at 538 9th Street in Oakland. And I do also want to tell people that there will be a different kind of demonstration tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the same place. The art will not be there. The art will be there on Saturday. But people are going to gather and talk and let the museum know how angry they are. And that's tomorrow at 3 o'clock at MoCA.
All right. All right, Barbara Lubin, thanks. We still have Nora with us, but Barbara, I want to thank you.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
And we'll talk to you soon.
And I hope you're going to be there, Dennis.
I'm going to be holding. I better be able to have a painting ready for me on Saturday. I'm going to be there.
For you.
I can't wait. I'm going to be there. Believe me, you could not hold me back. Thank you, Barbara.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. We still have Nora with us. Nora, I wanted to hold you on just to get a quick reaction. A lot of stuff happening at the United Nations about whether Palestine and Mahmoud, and there's going to be like statehood. A lot of people aren't crazy about either possibility here. What's your response?
Yeah, well, one of our bloggers today, Mohammed Suleiman, tweeted...
The Electric Intifada, yeah.
From the Electronic Intifada, said, not sure how this will work, but though I'm wholeheartedly against the statehood bid, and I'm just as wholeheartedly against the U.S. veto of it. And that kind of sums up exactly what's going on here. We know that the so-called two-state solution has been dead for years. We know that since, you know, the Oslo Accords of the mid-1990s, Israel has continued to carve up, you know, the occupied West Bank and insert over, you know, more than 500,000 settlers illegally under, you know, violations of international law into the West Bank. We know that it's continued its siege on Gaza. We know that there have been home demolitions, administrative detentions. We know that, of course, you know, the strange irony of this Palestine statehood bid is that it would become the 194th state that's recognized at the UN. Well, that number, 194, has a very interesting significance. Of course, we know that UN Resolution 194, which was passed in 1949, guarantees the right of return for Palestinian refugees to return to the land from which they were expelled as Israel was created. And under the statehood bid, it would absolutely negate Resolution 194. It would prevent Palestinian refugees, of whom there are more than 7 million around the world, from achieving that basic fundamental human right. And we know that Washington, you know, is going to veto it. Only because they want a so-called Palestinian state to be achieved only through negotiations with Israel. So, you know, again, Israel wins either way. If Palestine is still what it is today, which is an archipelago of Bantustans, you know, in this apartheid regime, then it, you know, it continues its status quo. If Palestine, in quotes, is regarded as a state, Israel has already said that it would withhold tax monies that it collects from Palestinians, that it would further expand the settlement colonies in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and that it would declare what they call a state of emergency, which is over and above the military occupation that is currently in place in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And you know, it's not really clear what that means, but it does not look good. You know, Palestinians also have not been told exactly what the statehood bid would look like. And there's a lot of concern that the Palestine Liberation Organization would be completely left out of the discussion, and that this Palestine state would be governed by the government in Ramallah, that it would be the Palestinian Authority who would answer to its funders and to the elite constituents, completely disregarding popular consensus. So this is, it's a very troubling time that we're up against when we look at the, you know, what's happening for the situation for ordinary Palestinians and especially Palestinian refugees.
All right, Nora, we're out of time. We want you to keep us posted on the trial. The analysis is very helpful. Nora is now contributor to the electronic intifada.net and to Al Jazeera, former senior producer here at Flashpoints. Again, we're out of time. Thanks, Nora.
Thank you.
And that does wrap it up for another edition of Flashpoints. It's produced by myself, Dennis Bernstein, with Miguel Gavilan Molina, Alyssa Buckman, and our newest member to the staff, Frank. What should we call you, Frank?
Freewheeling Franklin. It's fine with me.
Freewheeling Franklin. It's a pleasure to have you aboard. Welcome. Stay tuned.
Founded the Electronic Intifada and wrote One Country, a bold proposal to end the Israeli-Palestinian impasse? And which Pulitzer Prize-winning writer participated in the U.S. boat to Gaza? Alice Walker and Ali Abu Nima are speaking in a benefit for the Middle East Children's Alliance Maya Project, Clean Water for Children in Gaza, on Wednesday, October 5th, 7 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church of Oakland, 2619 Broadway, co-sponsored by KPFA. Tickets are $15, $10 low income, with info on www.mecaforpeace.org. That's MECAFORPEACE.ORG, or at 510-548-0542. This event is wheelchair accessible.
Stay tuned now for ED News. It's KPFA and Bert.